Hello and welcome to episode 17 of the State of 2020. This is a politics podcast, all about the ins and outs and in-betweens of American politics. My name is Steve Byrne. I am co-host of another politics podcast called What Am Politics. But my, I guess you can call it obsession or addiction to American politics means that I had to spin off to get another show just to talk about what's going on in the States. We also have with us, as usual, good old Jim Elliott.
Good old Jim Elliott. That's me. Hey, guys, you know me, American living in Dublin, originally from Washington, D.C. So I'm kind of used to paying too much attention to this kind of crap, especially in an election year. I'm a comedian. You can find me online, jimelliottcomedy.com. I'm on YouTube. I'm on YouTube. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. Ever since the pandemic kicked off, since there's no live comedy anymore, I've actually been cutting up old 40-second long bits of mine and putting them up on TikTok. So if you're on TikTok, I think I'm the oldest person on TikTok, but you can find some of my clips there because I'm just starved for any kind of engagement.
And also on the line, we have Kira Gilici. First time on the show. How's it going?
Yeah, great. So I work in digital marketing. I currently specialize in financial services, but in my spare time, I'm a bit of a political analyst on Twitter. I also have a website, redbluekicker.com.
Yeah, definitely recommend checking out that website. I learned lots from your analysis of the different campaign mails that have been sent around. But
yeah, that's super fun to read, actually. redbluekickthrough.com. It's just an analysis of all, because I and God bless you, Kara, because I am not signed up to receive any emails from any of these lunatics. So you're sacrificing sacrificing the sanctity of your inbox to take a look at how they're begging for money.
The Trump ones are especially bad, but yeah, look, someone's got to do it.
Yeah.
We'll get into that more at the end when we sum up the campaigns, but stripping back to Trump and not doing things well, last weekend he had a, what you can describe, I guess, as a car crash interview with Fox News' Chris Wallace. I've only seen clips myself. I couldn't bring myself to waste an hour of my life watching the President of the United States talking crap, but I think this one was especially nuts. Kira, do you want to talk to us first about just what was going on in the interview, and was there anything halfway decent in terms of seeing an American politician act?
Yeah, absolutely. I felt the same in terms of watching the whole thing, but I took a really good tip from the guys at Pod Save America and watched it at like 1.75 speed on YouTube. So it meant that they were talking really fast, but it made me get through it a lot quicker. So, I mean, I think it was a really strong interview for a number of reasons. So firstly, Chris Wallace, who's a Fox News reporter, he asked really, really tough questions. Not necessarily like any tougher than other journalists have asked, but he actually forced Trump to answer them. So that contrasts a lot with what we've been seeing with some of the more liberal media when they question Trump in the Rose Garden and he kind of tries to pass off as fake news. Mm. And then also because Fox News actually fact-checked a lot of what he said. So whenever Trump and Wallace disputed any of the points on COVID or on police brutality, Fox kind of added in a separate cutaway where they showed where they got their information from versus where the White House got their information from. And I thought that worked really, really well. I think probably the main reason why it's got so much media attention isn't necessarily because Wallace was the first journalist to ask Trump these tough questions, but also because it aired on Fox and Trump seemed to be kind of more aware of the actual viewers that be watching Fox. They were obviously going to be Republican. They're going to be his voters. And he was more willing to engage as a result. And I think he did maybe let his guard down a little bit. Everyone's obviously talking about this cognitive test that he brought up when they were discussing Biden. So I think it kind of started by Trump saying that Biden doesn't even know he's alive. And Wallace kind of challenging him about the cognitive test and saying that he took it as well. So Trump was saying it was a really difficult test and Wallace was kind of giving examples of some of the questions. So you had to point out whether an animal was an elephant or a rhino. You had to count backwards from 100. And I think the worrying thing there was that Trump seemed to be bragging about how he thought the test was difficult, but he managed to complete it. Mm. And I guess the point there that everyone's been talking about is that a cognitive test is not supposed to be difficult. Like yeah. If you're fully cognitive, you're not supposed to find it hard to complete. So that in itself was worrying, but it did make for some good reporting over the following few days. I think some of the kind of smaller points that were a little bit more worrying that he brought up were that he kind of really emphasized that he was going to be passing on the accountability for bringing down COVID to state governors. So he mentioned that, you know, he's in favor of masks, but it's up to the state governors to enforce that. So he's not going to step on their toes. And that just really kind of passes the accountability. It makes him not responsible for anything that does or doesn't happen within the states. And that's kind of been his tactic from the start. But I just thought it was interesting that he finally admitted that he was in favor of masks, but just that he wasn't actually going to tell people to wear them. He also referred to the school reopening, which has obviously been a scandal over the past few weeks, and he indicated that they wouldn't be providing federal funding to schools who didn't reopen. I think the federal budget provides about 10% of schools' funding, and Chris Wallace rightly kind of called out that, you know, that funding tends to go to the more disadvantaged students or disabled students who need it. But Trump kind of blatantly said that they wouldn't be funding if they didn't reopen, which is quite a scary reality, I think.
Yeah, some of the districts that are saying they're not going to reopen being Los Angeles and San Diego, which, you know, large cities on the West Coast that probably do capture a lot of disadvantaged areas as well. Jim, people have been talking about a tonal shift in Trump's media outbursts since this interview. Do you think he was taken to task by Chris Wallace and has kind of changed his tactics since then?
I think Chris Wallace was one of the first people just to straight up answer with no, he didn't, on a couple of points. So like when Trump was saying that Joe Biden signed a pact where he wants to defund the police, and Chris Wallace was like, no, he does not. And Trump did the thing, we've got a copy of it right here, we'll find it. And then later they cut to a voiceover with Chris Wallace going, he did provide the document that Joe Biden signed. It does not mention defunding the police. So moments like that where Chris Wallace was like, no, we don't. When Trump said that America has a lot more cases, but if you look at the death toll, our mortality rate is really low. And Chris Wallace was like, no, it isn't.
Yeah.
I think just that sort of basic, that's factually incorrect, Mr. President, exchange, which had been lacking in any other format. I guess it is remarkable that that a Fox News reporter would conduct themselves that way. Do I think that's preceded any kind of a tonal shift out of Trump? Absolutely not. In fact, the entire interview itself, I think, was nothing more than what we've gotten from Trump since day one. He hasn't changed at all. It's not the constant denial of responsibility and claims of victimization. So, you know, it's not my responsibility to tell people to wear masks or to organize any sort of a federal response to a goddamn pandemic.
But
and then the claiming that the schools will all be closed until November 3rd, specifically to damage him politically. So it's that whole, he lies like a child who's caught. It's not my fault. And why are you so mean to me?
But that's like what happened on Sunday. But then let's just say that he had a coronavirus briefing since then, where he has for the first time admitted that it's going to get worse
before it gets better, which is the quote that everybody's fixated on. But he still, even in the coronavirus briefing on Wednesday, was just downplaying, is saying that the reason that we're catching more cases is because we're testing more and that the mortality rate's very low. And none of these things are true. So yes, he did say it's going to get worse before it gets better. So that's the first time he hasn't done that stupid blind optimism thing where he goes, one day the virus is just going to disappear, or when the sun comes out in the summer, the virus is going to go away. I love the fact that he's wearing a mask now and saying, well, I've always said that masks might help, but I'm just going to leave it up to people. No, he didn't. And we saw you not doing that. I think the most amazing tonal shift that came after Sunday's interview is that after Sunday's interview, they decided to start the coronavirus briefings again. Like, we were having regular coronavirus briefings, and then we had to stop them because of the lunacy he was spouting, where he was like, look, drink bleach, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
That was the last one they had. They were like, all right, cause that was on that was late in the week and it went through the weekend. That was the whole story. And they're like, all right, we're going to scale these back. It's just a matter of getting him in front of cameras or not. You get him in front of cameras and he waffles on stuff that he doesn't, because he doesn't know about this stuff. He doesn't read and he doesn't listen. So no, I don't think there's any kind of a tonal shift out of it. I think Chris Wallace, good interview. And I think he seems to be getting universal praise from every corner of the media. So he did himself pretty good this week. He had a good week.
Has either of you seen what the reaction has been, maybe from the Trump base to Chris Wallace? Are they demanding that he's taken off Fox News for being disloyal or anything like that?
Fox News is barely covering. So, okay, they aired the interview, but then, you know, the clips that we're talking about that every other news station is covering, if you watch Fox right now, it's like that interview never happened. Like, they're just not giving it any airtime. And so, you know, outside of the original 6 million people that watched it, I don't know how anybody could have watched it and thought that Trump seemed competent at all.
I think within the interview as well, Fox News did quite a good job of kind of emphasizing how Chris Wallace had been critical of a lot of Democrats as well. His interview with Nancy Pelosi, they brought that up and showed how he was critical of her at the start of coronavirus. His interview with James Comey as well. So I think that positioned themselves very well to show Republican viewers that, you know, they're not being overly critical of Trump. They're just being as transparent as they could be. So I think they did that within the interview quite well. But yeah, post coverage has been non-existent, basically. Although interestingly, on YouTube, they're still allowing comments on the interview video, which they
good
never do.
Good times.
So interesting, yeah.
Actually, side question. Is Fox, are they back on Twitter? They stopped tweeting for a little while there. Let me look that up.
Oh, I haven't noticed. Can't say I follow them, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, I know. But
I am a subscriber on YouTube for a bit of hate watching every now and again.
Ugh. What does that do to your YouTube algorithm?
Moving on then, I think it happened last week. Ivanka Trump held up a can of beans in what looked like a hotel room and was essentially just acting as if she was on the front of a 50s Housewives magazine trying to sell them. I have no idea what Goya beans were before that. I don't really know what they are after that. Is she an owner of Goya beans and is she trying to sell them? And then Trump, I think, followed up with a whole selection of their products on the Resolute desk.
On the desk.
On the Resolute desk in the Oval Office.
Such a surreal.
It was a very, surreal very surreal. Kira, I'm going to ask you, can you please explain to me what the hell was going on with Goya beans and the Trump family?
Yeah, absolutely. Look at me. So I think it all started, I think, on July 9th. So the president of Goya Foods, Bob Unanu, was speaking with Trump at the White House. And in his comments, he mentioned that Trump is an incredible builder, referring to the wall that Trump is obviously building at the border. And I think given statements that Trump has made in the past about the Hispanic immigrant community, so calling Mexicans rapists, his anti-immigration deportation policies and everything that's going on at the border with kids in cages, and then also his views on DACA, I suppose it's not hugely surprising that that same community were very offended when the president of the largest distributor of Hispanic foods in the US commented that he thought that Trump was an incredible builder. So Goya Foods are a really big distributor of Hispanic foods, and I think that's where the tie was.
Okay.
So what happened then was, yeah. What happened then was this boycott. So hashtag boycott Goya was trending. And I think that sort of incited a bit of rage in Trump because he seems to be really offended by this cancel culture that he has newly discovered. He mentioned it in his Chris Wallace interview as well. And I think he's just, he feels that it's attacking businesses. And we all know he cares about businesses more than he cares about people. So he, in order to kind of promote Goya and to stop this cancel culture, I think himself and Ivanka both posted images on Instagram. So Ivanka posted the image with the beans, and then he posted on at the Oval Office with an array of Goya products on his desk. Obviously, that kind of violates government ethics rules because he's promoting a third-party business interest from the Oval Office. Do I think it's going to impact his poll numbers or, you know, his base voters? Probably not. I don't think that it's going to sway the conversation either way.
There's not going to be any accountability at all for this illegal act. Exactly. Because on the realm of illegal acts, like, yeah, it's illegal, but what harm does it do really? Like, you're not getting impeached for something like this, even though it is just ridiculous, though.
I wonder if you look into the numbers of Goya produce, have they actually gone down from people boycotting them following on from Trump trying to fight back against the boycott?
Man, I never bought that boycott anyway, because the boycott, I refuse to believe that the hashtag resistance boycott of Goya Foods ever went anywhere past Twitter, nor do the people, I think, who tweet about boycotts in response to something like somebody praising Trump. I don't think they buy a lot of Goya products. I think straight up it's sort of
Yeah,
it's I saw overly media exposed college educated white liberals like the three of us on this podcast, who I don't think that's Goya's base. You know what I mean?
A few tweets where people had like pictures of them in supermarkets where they like take a picture of the bean aisle because apparently there's bean aisles, and you know other beans were gone off the shelves, but Goya was still there. I mean,
that's what I miss most since I moved to Ireland. I miss the bean aisle. I don't like that, no bean aisle.
I mean, yeah, I was looking for some fancy beans recently, and we just do baked beans. If you're listening from outside of Ireland,
and it tears me up inside.
Beans and ketchup is basically all Irish people are about. Moving on from whatever the hell the Goya bean thing was then to something more important. And we lost John Lewis, one of the last heroes of the civil rights movement, passed away. And we're talking like proper civil rights, dude. He was in his early 20s. I think he was a student organizer around the Martin Luther King era, was involved in all the big things down in Alabama, trying to get people registered to vote. And he went on then to have a very long and fruitful career in Congress, and he passed away. Timely, I guess you could say, in that we're still in the middle of the latest wave of the Black Lives Matter protest and fights for further civil rights for people of color in the United States. So, Kira, you were pretty struck by, I guess, the negative, or if you want to call it that, the conservative reaction to John Lewis.
Yeah, I mean, I think John Lewis was so instrumental in the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Like, he marched from Selma to Montgomery at that time, and the reaction of some of the kind of conservative politicians in America to his passing, like, they were kind of, you know, they were saying really nice words about him, which would be great if they hadn't spent, you know, the last 20 years of their life trying to dismantle things that he's trying to get across the board. So an example is the Voting Rights Advancement Act, which has been sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk for 230 days now. And Mitch McConnell then issued a statement where he, you know, reminisced about holding hands with John Lewis in 2008 at a ceremony for Martin Luther King Jr. And it felt so false, considering if he wanted to do the right thing and if he believed in what John Lewis believes in, he should be, you know, putting that Voting Rights Advancement Act to a vote in the Senate.
Yeah.
John Lewis was the one who kind of led the passage of it in Congress or in the House. So it's kind of disparaging to see them try to kind of jump on board and act as though that they've been a friend of civil rights for the last 6 years, when actually they're the very people that John Lewis has been fighting his whole life against.
Yeah, I guess we should specifically talk about this for a moment. So after the civil rights era, I think it was it might have actually been the Nixon administration, certainly part of driven in the Johnson administration. They brought in special federal instructions on states so that they wouldn't be able to jerry-rig their systems within the states to basically stop Black people from having a vote. There used to be insanely complex loopholes that you had to jump through only if you were a person of color. So things like had to pass a literacy test.
Those weren't in every district.
No, they weren't. And they were only in what was called the Jim Crow South. They tried to get rid of all that as much as they could with the civil rights and voting rights legislations that were brought in. But I think it was recently enough that the Supreme Court of the United States, which we're going to talk about later, overturned that and said that the states were now allowed to judge for themselves what kind of voting systems that they want to have.
It was 2013. There was a Supreme Court ruling that invalidated some of the Voting Rights Act from 1965 in a number of states that were mostly in the South.
Would this legislation that John Lewis had got in, the basically Voting Rights Plus, would that have helped to overturn that and make it?
Exactly, yeah. That was what the purpose of that was, and that was what he passed in the House, and it's been waiting for a vote in the Senate. But Mitch McConnell, as leader of the Senate, hasn't allowed the vote, and it's been sitting there for, I think, 230 days now. So there's a lot of calls now for people to rename it the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, and I think that'd be a really nice sentiment, but whether or not it would actually be done.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty obvious to see that a white senator from Kentucky probably wouldn't want to have as many voters being able to vote against them as possible, if then that's his imperative. And he's such a blatant political player that he would just leave it sitting on the desk no matter whose name was on it. He wouldn't care.
Yeah, that thing is not going anywhere. The only way to get that to move at all will be if we can flip the Senate in November, and then they'll have to reintroduce it. but there's no way this Congress is going to look at it. It's just like, come on. And to anybody who, yes, call out the hypocrisy of Mitch McConnell, issuing a statement on John Lewis's death, but don't for a minute be surprised by it. Like, utterly predictable.
It wasn't just him. I think you, Kira, you mentioned there was Marco Rubio as well, and like the whole score of conservative Republican senators that are and congressmen that are refusing to do anything to actually push it forward. What's your look?
I liked how was it Paul Ryan? I think who tweeted a photo of himself.
Is and he still around?
A black guy who was not John Lewis.
Oh no!
And was like,
Marco Rubio actually
was it Marco Rubio?
There was a couple of them that did that, I think. But Marco Rubio was the first, and he deleted it a couple minutes later. But
And then it was followed up by other politicians making the same mistake. But look, if we were to talk about the hypocrisy of the Republican congressional parties, we'd be here for a while. Yeah. Let's talk about other kind of hypocrisy. So even though the Republican Party is supposed to be all about states' rights and no over encroachment of the federal government, at the moment in Portland, Oregon, every single night during protests, there are unidentified federal officers wearing basically military fatigues, driving around in rental vans, like the kind of things that a family would get when they're down in Disney World, and grabbing people off the street and basically disappearing them. Mm-hmm. It's insane. I mean,
it's insane. And you don't see any of the Second Amendment guns rights protecting from tyranny crowd. They're not out there trying to help. They've narrowed it down now. It's mostly Department of Homeland Security guys, which is amazing in and of itself that the Homeland Security, the DHS, is supposed to protect the U.S. from outside threats. So to be deploying them against Americans in an American city is unconscionable. But I'm hoping that the defund the police movement will turn into the just eliminate the Department of Homeland Security. It was a rushed through piece of crap department that happened after September 11th. And I fail to see what value they provide to society at all. Although Trump has said now that he's going to be deploying these forces in other places as well. He specifically called out Chicago, but then he always calls out Chicago when he talks about crime rates. And it remains to be seen if the state of Illinois will allow that to happen.
Well, you say the state of Illinois allowed it to happen. Isn't it the case in Portland, which is in the state of Oregon, that the mayor of Portland and the governor of Oregon have not asked for this to happen?
So nope. They're currently suing the federal government for kidnapping. So it's an interesting sort of power struggle.
I mean, the mayor of Portland actually got tear gassed last night.
Yeah, limited sympathy there. He's been cool with the people of Portland being tear gassed for 2 months now. So. It's the fact that he doesn't happen to own the tear gas in question that seems to be offending him.
I think as well, it's important to kind of call out that the reason why these paramilitary agents have been sent there is to protect this executive order that Trump signed that says that like monuments and federal property and statues need to be protected. Mm-hmm. Whatever about the craziness of actually deploying paramilitary within the United States, the fact that they're doing it to protect statues and monuments, it's absolutely crazy.
They seem to be surrounding the federal courthouse in Portland, which you can understand why the federal government would not want their courthouse to be torched, I guess. It's absolute carnage every night. And
there are other ways
really
to do it. And just to be explicit, the American system is built on having like a duality of power between states and federal government. And if the states are saying, leave us alone, in most instances, the federal government is supposed to leave them alone. Mm. And I mean, I would also like to say, I don't know if this necessarily would be different under the Obama or the future Biden administration. Like, do you actually think that the Democrats would hold back on sending in these kind of things into, like, wasn't there cases that the same kind of thing was happening in Ferguson under Obama as well?
Obama was pretty ruthless in breaking up both the Occupy movement and the original iteration of Black Lives Matter in Ferguson. So I don't know that you can paint this as entirely in the same way that you can't really paint Trump as 100% of the problem. He's more of a symptom of the sort of media saturation and headline driven politics that this era is. You know, if Trump were to disappear tomorrow, it's not like everything would be fine. So I do think that's a good call out, Steve.
moving on then as well, I suppose, still talking about the intricacies of federal government, one of the liberal bastions of the Supreme Court, which is essentially the Supreme Court is the final decider of all things in American politics. They are the people that get to decide on things of constitutionality, whether or not the government can basically do something or not, gets the final say in the Supreme Court. And it's been very important in recent times. It was what upheld Barack Obama's healthcare mechanisms and policies. It was also what has essentially legalized same-sex marriage across the United States. Even though certain states don't allow it within their territory, they have to acknowledge same-sex marriage licenses from other states, which wasn't the case before the Supreme Court coming in. And that is only a fraction of the kind of stuff that we get out of the Supreme Court. So it is pretty scary to see that one of the main liberal voices on the court has got ill. So she... there was some breaking news about her being admitted to hospital last week, and then she spoke herself about her liver cancer coming back, but she insists that she will be able to continue to work. Kira, do you think there will be, do you think if she passes away within the Trump term, it'll end up being the kind of thing that'll hang over American politics for years? Because I suppose it's also worth calling out that you're appointed to the Supreme Court for life. It's up to you whether you want to retire, or you either retire or you die. Nobody can remove you. So if Trump has a chance to add another conservative judge, yeah, it'll make a difference.
I think like, you know, firstly, it's really sad that at 87 years of age, you know, she has liver cancer, and the fact that Ruth Bader Ginsburg has to kind of continue to serve despite the fact that she's, like, you know, she's been a Supreme Court justice since 1993. She should be able to step down.
Yeah.
But the fact that she kind of has to keep going because,
that's a good point,
because of this the situation that we're in right now is I think really, really sad.
It's like something from Game of Thrones almost. Is like,
yeah,
it's like a title.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I feel really bad for her, and I think it's great that she is continuing to serve, even though she's currently getting chemotherapy for liver cancer. But it'll be interesting if she does pass away, it'll be interesting to see what take Mitch McConnell in particular has on it. Because when Anthony Scalia passed away in February 2016, I think it was, Mitch McConnell refused to accept a presidential nomination because it was an election year. And as a result, Trump has now gotten to nominate two Supreme Court justices in his less than 4-year term. So he's nominated Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh as well, all in one term, which is quite a lot. I mean, if you got three across the line, it would really change the face of the Supreme Court for the next 40 years. So whether or not Mitch McConnell sticks to his principles and says, oh, huh, you know, it's an election year, we'll wait till the new president is elected before nominating another justice, I think that's very, very unlikely. It would be the case, I'd say, where Trump will have a nominee pretty quickly, and the Senate will vote almost immediately to ratify that. So it is worrying. And I think when you look at kind of the current split of the Supreme Court, five of the justices have been nominated by Republican presidents and four by Democrats. So if Ruth Bader Ginsburg did pass away and there was a Republican nominee chosen in her stead, it would kind of flip the court to be 6-3. Republican versus Democrat, or conservative versus liberal. So that is quite worrying, especially when you see some of the things that the Supreme Court have already managed to do or dismantle, I should say, since Trump has come into power. So yeah, it's a scary situation, and, you know, wishing her all the best.
Mm. Yeah, I don't think I don't know if history will remember McConnell's stealing of that Supreme Court justice nomination from Obama as the unbelievable act of thievery, and call it out, bravery, that it was. I couldn't believe it every day when it was going through it, that he was able to block the nomination for that long. And I can't believe how well it worked out for the Republicans.
It emphasizes kind of how important it is as well to try flip the Senate in November, because no matter if Biden does get elected, it's not going to change a huge amount if Mitch McConnell is still blocking bills, and you know, if Biden did get to choose a Supreme Court justice in his term, if he was elected, it'd be difficult to even get them across the line with Mitch McConnell heading up the Senate.
You think Mitch McConnell would block it for 4 years?
Maybe not 4 years, but maybe block the
he'd try. Why wouldn't he try?
Oh, well, in for a penny, I mean, in for a pound.
Yeah. He'd try and then maybe start a bit of impeachment as well to try and speed up the 4-year process, probably.
Yeah, and I mean, it is worth saying that this is the kind of things with the intricacies of the American system that it really matters to win at all levels, even if the Senate is a really shitty institution that's designed to basically keep the Republicans in power in its current stead. It's also worth pointing out, like, we didn't really touch on the importance of our BG as she is. She is essentially a liberal force of nature who has picked up a lot of the, I guess, acclaim of the left-wingers of late. She's essentially a feminist icon. She works incredibly long hours, even while she's, as you said, what, 87?
87,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Still going strong. And also, I think, drinking strong, maybe correlated to her illness, we don't know.
She's got liver cancer, Steve.
So, yeah, it's worth saying that losing her, even despite the political ramifications, it's going to be a huge deal for the left wing movement as itself, to if she was to not be around anymore. I guess we can move on now to Kanye West.
Dude. Are you guys actually taking, you're not taking this seriously, are you, Steve? Kira?
Somebody just asked me today, could he win?
And no, I know. I get asked that a lot, but not by people who I would consider serious thinkers about politics.
But I couldn't answer seriously. I was trying to.
You couldn't answer seriously?
I was trying to go, no fucking way. But then I remembered I said the same thing in 2015 about the current president of the United States.
Well, there's a little bit of a different thing there, because the current president of the United States actually had the apparatus of a political party that he hijacked that meant that he was on the ballot in all 50 states. Kanye doesn't have that. You can't just, contrary to how it might have seemed when Donald Trump ran through the Republican field, he didn't just announce it on Twitter and go on and win, which is what Kanye's doing right now, which is Kanye is... The man has a bipolar disorder and is clearly in the middle of a manic episode. Like, I can't believe that this is taken so. There's a comedian I like by the name of Seton Smith, who has a bit about Kanye. Whenever Kanye comes out and says something crazy in the media, and everybody goes, "Oh my God, Kanye, listen to this thing that he thinks." The guy's got mental health problems to the tune of being institutionalized every couple of years. People like that come out with some wild stuff to say, and everybody then runs with it like it's part of some well thought out plan of his. I can't believe that it's actually, I mean, I can believe, but I wish it didn't get the traction in the media that it did.
Yeah, I think I kind of agree with you, Stephen, that I've been reluctant to not take it seriously because I didn't for Donald Trump.
We all got burned 3 years ago. I remember.
I was in denial, but I see what you're saying, Jim, and that, like, he hasn't thought it through. Like, he's not, it's not like he's joining the race when it was at a primary level. It's too far gone now for him to make any, like, real impact in terms of him winning. But could he take away votes from Biden? I mean, 2 weeks ago, I would have said yes, substantially. Now, given how he's run the campaign so far, I think even the voter base that may have voted for him are now questioning him and questioning his ideologies and his beliefs because of the things that he said at recent rallies. So, like, it's really confusing there. Can we just, so I even am very confused about the timeline of this. So he announced on the 4th of July that he was running in 2020. He'd missed the deadline at that point for Indiana, Maine, New Mexico, New York, North Carolina, and Texas. North Carolina, of those, being the only swing state. So at that point, I was kind of worried. I was like, okay, you know, he could still steal 5 of the swing states if he really put a lot of effort into it. He had Elon Musk backing him. And then on July 15th, there were reports from his own staff, like a member of this campaign staff went on the record and said that he's dropped out after he hired 180 people in Florida, but he failed to get the 132,000 signatures he needed to get on the Florida ballot. And then 4 days later, on July 19th, he's launching his campaign at a rally in South Carolina. Like, it's just, it's so sporadic. I have no idea what's going on. And then apparently he needed to collect 10,000 signatures for the South Carolina ballot, but then failed to submit the petition in time. So it's just, it's very, I mean, he's definitely sick. And I think, you know, that plays into it quite a lot. But at the same time, there's a whole campaign behind him apparently that are allowing him to do this or are promoting this.
Yeah,
you know, getting those signatures. He has campaign staff out trying to rally, you know, people within those states. So
they're taking his money is what they're doing.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, I've been talked off the ledge now. I guess we can assume that it isn't any kind of actual political force of nature that is going to actually cause upset. And we are just witnessing, another Kanye manic episode live on the news feeds and Twitter. I guess we should take the advice of his wife, as she released yesterday, and says, please be kind, compassionate, and gentle.
Please stop taking everything he says so seriously, you schmucks.
It was a really good statement from her, in fairness. Like, I think from a PR point of view, she handled that quite well, especially given what he had said about her and about the family. But I mean, we do need to remember as well, his album is being released, I think, later this week or early next week.
So funny that.
That feeds into it as well. So if this is all a publicity stunt for his album, I won't be too mad. But if he does try to dismantle democracy, then that's a whole different issue.
Dismantle democracy? Driving force to bring democracy to America, you mean? Okay. So at the moment, it does look like Joe Biden is basically coasting on a super slippy slide all the way to the White House in November. He is so far ahead in the national polls that
it's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. And in comparison to the history and before, it's like all the car crash presidential campaigns. For I think he's further ahead than Clinton was against Bush 1. He is about the same as Reagan was ahead of Jimmy Carter. All the way back to God knows whoever was president in 1832 and whatever that way that went. But this is basically looking very strong for Joe Biden. I guess with all the caveats that we are still far away, opinion polls have been wrong in the past, and God only knows what is going to happen in the year of 2020 between now and November. But I guess, Kira, going back to you first, do you think his lead in the swing states, especially among the voters that may not have come out for Hillary, are the kind of things that's could allow him to coast his way into the presidency?
Yeah, I mean, I think the polls are positive and it's great to see. But I mean, it's very early days. And I think even in the swing states, I'm so reluctant to take it for granted. And I think the polls are only, not that they're serving a bad purpose, but they serve the purpose to get people more relaxed about it and to go into the election with the same apathy that they went into for Clinton in 2016. I think in order for the Biden campaign to really kind of push it and actually get that 270, it's not a question of just relying on polls and swing states. They need to be getting that message out there that whatever you've done so far is not enough. And that's something that Barack Obama has kind of spoken about quite a lot whenever he's tied himself to the Biden campaign. I think it's a really good message for them to be having, considering how the polls portrayed Hillary back in 2016. I think as well, a lot can change very quickly in that, to your point earlier, Steve, about Trump kind of changing his tone. I don't think he's changed his tone completely, but I think he certainly, you would think that he had based on how the media are covering it. And I think that's the point, in that he makes the slightest change, the slightest admission of guilt, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, he's changed his ways. It changes things completely. Like the bar is on the ground in terms of what Trump needs to do to get any sort of good press. He doesn't tweet for a day and all of a sudden everyone's like, oh, his new campaign manager has reeled him in. So I think things can change very, very quickly. And we still have a number of months to go. I'd also be a bit concerned as well about the vote by mail. So obviously the Democrats have been the ones kind of really pushing for vote by mail, and Trump and a lot of his administration have been against it, despite the fact that they have obviously voted by mail numerous times in the past. But I don't think just because the Democrats are the ones pushing for vote by mail that means that vote by mail will work in favor of the Democrats. When you look at the California 25th special election that took place back in May between Christy Smith and Mike Garcia, that was one of the first ones that was kind of going to be, not, I wouldn't say fully mail-in ballots, but it was a really big emphasis on it. And, you know, it's a California, it's a blue state. There was, you know, this impression that Christy Smith was going to run away with it, but actually it went in favor of Mike Garcia, despite the fact that Trump had spoken out a week before saying that it was going to be a fraudulent election, that the mail-in ballots were going to impact it. So I think we shouldn't necessarily take for granted that if everyone's voting by mail, it will be, not that it will be in favor of the Democrats, but that it will be business as usual. I think it will greatly change the way in which we we would expect election results to come across. And I think that's still to be seen as to what impact that will have.
Mm. That's huge. And I think you hit something really big there when you talk about the way in which we consume the election results. That's something that I've only seen a couple of articles talking about. Say, you know, say COVID continues on the path it's on and everybody votes by mail come November, right? What that is going to do is that it'll be pointless to watch TV the evening of November 3rd, anticipating seeing any kind of results. It'll take weeks for actual results to come out of each state. So that delay in and of itself, what do you do with a president who, even when he was a candidate, didn't promise that he would honor the results of the election? You guys remember that when he was still just a candidate?
Yeah. Yeah.
Somebody asked him
if
are you going to accept the results of the election? And he said, if I win. So, you know, what do we do with a 3-week
window? Which was a lie too, actually. He didn't win when he won.
With a 3-week window between November 3rd and when you can start to anticipate actual results coming in. You know, say you've got Florida and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Iowa, and then and I don't know, pick another swing state, Arizona, why not? And the results are not in yet. What's Trump's Twitter feed going to look like in between then and when those states declare? What, you know, what kind of pressure are they going to come under? What's the Department of Homeland Security troops going to be doing then? If you want to, Steve, I talked you off the ledge with Kanye. Let's go down the rabbit hole of some dark thoughts here. What the hell happens during the month of November when this goes down? So
I put that back to you, Jim. Like, what do you actually think will happen? I mean, if he is like essentially an outgoing president with a Twitter account, what we've seen the military tack against him after he cleared out Lafayette Square photo shoot. Yeah. And what do you think the American states as itself would do? Like what are we talking about here?
Yeah, no, it's so apart what I'm talking about is
spinning dark clouds.
Spinning dark clouds, exactly. Well, first off, what I'm meaning is that I don't think it's going to be as dominant, like 100% mail-in ballot. I think there are ways, like if you can open a restaurant during COVID and do it intelligently by having people sit outside and away from each other and all the staff masked up and you scrub down all the tables in between, then you can run, if inefficiently, but you can run a polling station like that. So I don't know that mail-in voting is going to be it's not going to be 100% mail-in voting. But I do think there is going to be some mail-in voting. And I think that might be enough to delay the results in some states. All of that other dark cloud stuff about DHS and claims from the sitting president about massive electoral fraud, man, I really hope that doesn't happen. And I just hope that the institutions themselves, meaning the state electoral commissions themselves, are strong enough to stand up to whatever chaos is coming.
Yeah, hope so too.
Good times, baby.
I think no matter how badly he loses or what the results are, or whether it's mail-in or not, I think we can probably expect that Trump will contest the election or not accept the results in any situation. He's kind of teeing it up for that already with some of the comments that he's made around the fraudulent voting around Biden and the Russians.
Do you mean not accept in that, like, he'll tweet about having gotten robbed until the day he dies? Yeah. Or do you mean not accept in, like, actually won't leave the White House in January?
Yeah.
No, so I think like that's a lot of people have been like worried over the last few days after his comments at the end of the Chris Wallace interview about not accepting the results, that he would like stake out the White House and not leave. Like, I absolutely don't think that's going to be the case, because he's a businessman. He knows that he can probably gain more by leaving the White House and making a big deal out of it, going back to Wall Street and you know, tweeting about it until the day he dies. I don't even fundamentally think he loves his job right now. No. I think he'll probably be glad in some ways to get out.
He hates it. He loved the first 2 years where there was nothing real serious to deal with. But right now, dude, he's a guy that hates his job.
I say it before and I say it again. Donald Trump never wanted to run for president. Donald Trump wanted to set up Donald Trump TV.
Which he can now go do.
With the added grievance of the real president's television station.
Mm.
Kira, just before we finish, we've talked a good few times in the last couple of episodes about the Veep stakes and who Joe Biden is going to pick as his candidate. Do you think who he picks will make a difference on the ticket, or do you think it's just Politico Twitter talk?
So I think if he went, like, so he's obviously said that he's going to pick a female candidate, and there's been a lot of speculation that he'll pick a black female candidate. So I think if he went against that and for some reason picked, you know, a white male, I think that would be detrimental to him. Like, that would definitely impact the ticket. But I think as long as he kind of keeps up his word, I don't think it's going to be a huge difference as to whether or not he picks Stacey Abrams versus Karen Bass versus Kamala Harris. Like, I think all of those candidates are really well qualified for it. And I don't think there's any particular state that he needs to pick a candidate in that will automatically guarantee him that that state will swing for him. It's more of a case that I think when people are looking at Joe Biden's vice presidential pick, they need to be reassured that this candidate will be ready to step up as president, because obviously he's 77, or he will be if he takes office. So whoever he picks needs to be somebody that is robust enough and has enough experience in DC to be able to continue the presidency if he does pass away.
Do you have a preference yourself?
So Karen Bass is actually my local congresswoman in California. So I'd love if she got it, but I also really like Stacey Abrams. So I think she's phenomenal. And I did for a while kind of think, oh, she hasn't got enough experience. You know, she could do it a few more years, political experience. But then, I mean, you can't really use that excuse anymore when you look at Trump. And I think, you know, I think she's really motivated, and she's done a great job so far with Fair Fight. So I think she'd be a great candidate as well. But I'd say he'll probably go for somebody that's a bit more, that's been in kind of the system for a bit longer.
I was going to say your senator is probably the most likely, I think, to get it, Kamala Harris.
Yeah, I mean, I really like Kamala as well, but I think she would probably maybe be the most, maybe not the most controversial, but obviously there was a bit of back and forth with them throughout the primaries, and I don't think she's as easy a nominee because she did have that, she did run herself, I suppose. So, I mean, I think I'd be happy enough with her as well, but I just don't know whether that would go down as well with voters.
So I'm on a popular gambling website's odds page right now, just to see who is leading the Democratic vice presidential nomination from the bookies' point of view. And so Kamala Harris is trending at even. So 50-50. Okay. That's not great gambling odds, but it looks like they have decided that they think she's the most likely to get it. Susan Rice is 3-1, Tammy Duckworth 6-1, Val Demings 12-1, Elizabeth Warren 12-1 as well. Karen Bass 16-1, which is the same odds they're giving Michelle Obama. And Stacey Abrams is back at 22-1. So I don't think they're, I mean.
So my picks are not.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I think Stacey Abrams, unfortunately, has been essentially dismissed because, as you say, she doesn't have that executive experience that they're talking about. And also, apparently, she made the critical mistake of saying that she wants it, which you're not supposed to do in these instances.
Ugh. Yeah.
Yeah, which I think she campaigned pretty hard for. She did. She campaigned really strongly. But like, I was watching Hamilton recently, and obviously when it was released on Disney Plus, and there's this whole thing where Aaron Burr campaigns for the first time, and previously presidential candidates never campaigned, and it was seen as really strange that Aaron Burr was actually going out and asking people to vote for him, and that's why Thomas Jefferson was so frustrated. I know, and it's just funny that tradition is still
there's still some instances still there for of it, vice president.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, we'll wrap it up there, folks. Thanks very much to Jim and Kira for joining me to talk about all these different topics. It was certainly, I think we did a good enough job of covering nearly everything that's happened in the United States over the past 3 weeks. Hopefully there will not be as long before the next episode in your feeds. In the meantime, please do follow us on Twitter and Instagram. And the links to Jim and Kira's own accounts will be in the show notes. Thanks very much, and talk to you next time.
This has been a production of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.